Welcome to the Product Podcast, brought to you by Product School, the podcast where you get fresh insight from leaders at top tech companies and startups. Remember, you can learn product management in person at our 15 campuses worldwide or study with us online. Visit productschool.com to learn more about our courses. You can also hang out with the leaders from these podcasts at our hundreds of annual events and catch us at ProductCon, the world's largest PM conference that takes place every year across the United States and in London.
My name is Tandy. I'm a senior product manager in Uber on the marketplace team, where I lead the shared rides commercialization team. And thank you for taking the time out to be here. I'm hoping what I can give you from your time today is just a general definition and understanding of what is a tech marketplace business. What are the different flavors of marketplace businesses? They come in all shapes and sizes. Just kind of give you a large view of the history and the view of the world. Let's talk then a little bit about the tech that goes into building marketplace businesses. Growing, measuring, metrics, experimentation for marketplace businesses. And then lastly, I'm going to talk a little bit about what a marketplace product manager looks like. I've been doing this for about a year and a half now, so I'm also learning as I go, so I'm hoping I can impart some of the things I've learned along my journey. So let me start with telling you a little bit about me and contextualize how I got here. So I am from Bombay, or now known as Mumbai in India. That's where I was born and brought up. So I went to Philadelphia to study computer science at Bryn Mawr College, and studied there for my undergrad, and then decided that India was calling. I needed to try the entrepreneurship thing. So went back to Bombay for a year to build an early version of TaskRabbit, if people are familiar with that, which is essentially a gig economy marketplace for service providers, called Chachi.com. And I did that for a year, and as a 22-year-old, learned a lot, failed a lot, built a ton of cool stuff, met a ton of cool people, and then decided, hey, I actually needed a real paying job. So went back to the States, did product at Microsoft in Seattle for 5 years, where I worked first on the Windows team and then moved to do Microsoft research and build translation apps. And then about a year and a half ago, I moved to Uber to join the product team in the Uber Marketplace organization, focusing on pricing and matching problems for shared rides. So that's a little bit about me, a bit of a career PM. I kind of accidentally stumbled into it right out of college, tried the entrepreneurship thing, and it kind of always kind of was a very natural fit, and have been doing that ever since, and have loved every day of it. Enough about me. Let me tell you a little bit about what we're gonna cover today. So we're gonna spend a little bit of time talking about what are marketplaces. I wanna walk you through a brief history, give you some examples, like what marketplace businesses have evolved into over the years. I wanna spend a little bit of time then talking about technology. Like, what are the core components of a marketplace tech business? We'll specifically be focusing on matching, pricing, quality control, and rebalancing mechanisms. And then in the end, I'll spend about 10 minutes or so talking about product managing marketplaces specifically. A lot of what I'm gonna talk about today is going to be Uber-centric, because like that's the business I'm most familiar with, but it's pretty generalizable to other kinds of marketplace businesses as well, but I'll be pulling a lot of my knowledge from what I've learned at Uber. All right, so what is a marketplace business? A marketplace business is anything that matches the needs of 2+ groups of users. So here are some canonical examples, right? Let's take Postmates. Postmates takes the needs of eaters, matches them with businesses who want to offer food, and then a third set of delivery people who are willing to deliver food for money. Airbnb, people who have extra space in their homes, so people who need that space. Lyft and Uber, people who are willing to drive vehicles with people who need transportation. eBay, people who have things that they don't need anymore and want to sell them with people who want to buy them. Same with Etsy, Convoy, Handy, Craigslist, the OG marketplace, Redfin, Yelp. All of these are kind of canonical marketplace examples where essentially they're taking any 2 or more sets of customers and then kind of marrying their needs together in order to create a transaction and taking some revenue or a cut out of that transaction. That is kind of what a marketplace business. Let's kind of distribute our marketplace examples across different axes. So marketplaces can be services or goods. So goods like Etsy and eBay, Amazon falls here, services like Fiverr, Redfin, Angie's List, and so forth. Goods are kind of easier to do because it's easy to produce goods and get it from point A to point B. The infrastructure for that exists already. Services are harder. And services are harder to crack because a lot of services are not fungible. If I get a bad plumber from Angie's List, then my end-to-end experience with the platform is a poor one. Similarly with Airbnb, if I have a bad experience with an Airbnb host, that's not fungible. So it's taken the marketplace a while to kind of crack the end-to-end service industry, whereas goods kind of have been around for a while. Marketplaces can be aggregators or full-stack providers. So Craigslist, my favorite example of a canonical aggregator. Just a simple web page with a list of links of people who want to sell things, offer services, and on the other side, people who want those services or goods. On the other side, there are full stack providers. Handy, if people have used the cleaning service, canonical example of a full stack provider. From needing a cleaning service all the way through payments, finding you a provider, making sure they show up on schedule, payments, tips, reviews, full stack from the start of the need to the end of the need is serviced by that platform. So that's another kind of matrix along which to think about marketplaces. Marketplaces can offer commodities or specializations. So my third axis to think about marketplaces is commoditized services. So on one side, we have like eBay, Postmates, even Lyft and Uber all kind of sit in the commodity section. They're fungible things. Like if I get into car A versus car B versus car 3 in an Uber, doesn't matter. It's for the most part a commodity. On the other side, there are specialized goods and services. So we talked a little bit about Angie's List, same with Fiverr, Etsy. It depends on your specific needs and the person who's on the other side, what your quality of experience is. Same with any kind of like childcare or healthcare related marketplace. It's a very specialized service and therefore kind of the quality of the end-to-end experience matters. So a lot of marketplaces we see kind of fall along the spectrum as well. Marketplaces can create supply or aggregate pre-existing supply. So my kind of fourth axis to look at the marketplace businesses is either they're creating supply that didn't previously exist. Before Lyft and Uber existed, there wasn't a way for you to take your Prius out on the road and pick people up and drop them off. That would just be plain creepy. On the other side, there are aggregators who take an existing supply that exists in the market. So like plumbers and carpenters always existed, but then putting them in the platform, putting quality control and putting some kind of standardized pricing, organize that network. So that's another axis along which to think about marketplace businesses. So we talked about all these axes and kind of the distinction between these canonical examples. But the one thing that's common across any kind of marketplace network, any successful marketplace business you'll see, is that they reduce entropy between some kind of demand and some kind of supply. So whether it's cleaners on one side or plumbers or restaurants and eaters, users, consumers, companies on the other side, currently, any marketplace business has identified a market that's disorganized, has a ton of entropy in it, demand-supply connections are tenuous, and leverages that disorganization to create revenue. And secondly, they all rely on the power of network effects to fuel efficiency. I, as a user, could only find without Angie's List maybe one or two plumbers, but the availability of this network gave me access to a lot more plumbers, the time from request to the time to get my task completed got faster, got more efficient. There was standardized pricing, so I knew I was paying the right amount each time, and there was some quality control, so I made sure that the person coming over to do my task has been vetted in some way. And when you create efficiency in any kind of market, that is disruptive, it fuels growth. So for example, free Uber and Lyft, so around 2010, 2011, in Los Angeles, there were total aggregate, according to public records, of about 8 million or so taxi trips. 2013, about a year after Lyft and Uber launched, that number dropped to 6 million. But it's not simply taking a bunch of taxi trips and making people and putting them in Ubers and Lyfts. It more than 10x'd the actual size of the market itself. Why? Because previously the network inefficiencies that were existing in the taxi business just went away with Uber and Lyft and created demand that was latent previously and didn't exist. So it was taking people out of their own cars, some cases public transport, and putting them in Lyfts and Ubers, and just 10xing a market that previously was capped at around 8 million. So let's take a few canonical examples that I'll be walking through for the rest of my talk about my favorite marketplace examples. So let's take Uber. So Uber matches people who need transportation with people who can drive for income. Uber, full stack, real-time decision making, super hyper-localized, and actually created the demand that previously didn't exist. Yelp. So Yelp is connecting people who want restaurant recommendations or other business recommendations with the businesses themselves. Yelp, not a demand creator, it's a demand aggregator. These businesses already existed, but its power is in its recommendation and matching engine. DoorDash and other kind of DoorDash-like companies, Grubhub, Uber Eats, Swiggy, Zomato, what have you, are three-sided marketplaces, which is between restaurants, couriers, and eaters, which again is a supply aggregator, full stack, real-time, both creating supply that didn't previously exist and aggregating supply that already existed into a network. So let's talk a little bit at this point about how we got here. Over the last 20 or 30 or so years, service marketplaces have kind of gone through four clean chapters. And a lot of this has happened, one, because kind of the, as we go into the 2000s, the wider availability of LTE, 4G networks, smartphones, app stores, and so forth. So in the 1990s, we saw kind of the listing era. The Craigslist and Yelps of the world just offering a platform for people, like almost like chat rooms, to offer goods and services and consume goods and services. And then Craigslist and Yelp were so wide and offering so many different value propositions that the 2000s saw kind of an unbundling era. So we saw specific use cases being handled by things like Angie's List, Fiverr, TaskRabbit, and so forth. So essentially taking the Craigslist model and saying, I'm going to make this work for plumbers. I'm going to make this work for carpenters, and so forth. And then came the Uber for X era. So Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, Airbnb, kind of all happened in the 2008, 2009 space. And then specifically in the last 5 years or so, we've seen deeper managed marketplaces. So people who will offer you babysitters, people who will offer you healthcare providers, people who will offer you lawyers. These are very specific use cases, and we previously talked about commodities versus specialized services. These are your canonical specialized services. Like here, we build fungible services, replace an Uber driver with another one, doesn't matter. Here, replace your babysitter with someone you don't know and is not vetted, not okay. And being able to manage kind of the end-to-end service stack is kind of what's been, is starting to be cracked in the last 5 years or so. And why now? It's taken a ton of tech and market advances to enable marketplace businesses to thrive today. First, everyone had to have a smartphone in their pocket, both in the US and internationally. Whether that's through the availability of cheap Android phones in Asia or iPhone technology getting better and better, making it more affordable for people to buy them. Next, native apps and powerful geolocation APIs. So without native app stores on iOS and Android, with very powerful native APIs, a lot of this tech would not have been possible. Then came the availability of cheap LTE networks. In urban areas, having access to 4G connectivity reliably so I can pull out my phone and call an Uber made the proliferation of these businesses possible. Then Google Maps innovation and APIs. If Google Maps didn't offer their APIs to businesses like Lyft, it wouldn't be possible to build the transportation technology that relies on a platform of geolocation technology. And last, third-party payment services. While in the US we kind of take it for granted that we pull out our credit cards for everything, in Asia in particular, Asia and Africa, that's not necessarily the case. And that has been a changing trend over the last half decade in particular. So the availability and secondly, trust for third-party payment services transacting on your phone automatically without a cash interaction, having both users' mind shift and then kind of having the tech stack built in place, again, enabled the proliferation of a lot of these marketplace businesses internationally. So that was context. So key takeaways, marketplace businesses, anything that marries the needs of 2+ users and creates revenue out of that. Second, marketplaces are sometimes demand creating by creating efficiencies that previously were not possible, like our Los Angeles example. And marketplaces, while they started as very simplistic aggregators like Craigslist, are increasingly going deep. They're offering end-to-end services, they're offering end-to-end experiences, and then holding themselves accountable for them. And that has been something that's only possible with the advent of a lot of the technology we talked about in the previous slides. So now I'm going to shift and talk a little bit about the tech that goes into marketplace businesses. So far I've been talking kind of in generalized terms, but now I'm going to shift a little bit in talking about Uber-specific tech as canonical examples of what's transferable to the other businesses we are talking about. So usually when you see a marketplace business organized, there is a marketplace tech team at its heart that's responsible for matching, pricing, measurement, quality control, experimentation. But a lot of kind of the cold starting of marketplace businesses happen in these axles. So supply growth, recruiting drivers, going out there, building the infrastructure to onboard drivers onto the platform. Demand growth, doing promotions, subscriptions, getting riders to sign up for the platform. Safety and quality, making sure that the people on our platform are safe and are not going to commit crimes. Ops, having people on the ground transacting with both the people and the governments. And then the user experience of using the app, making it intuitive to click a button, call a ride. All of these teams exist kind of on the periphery of the marketplace tech team that kind of does the pumping of the blood across all of these different teams, making the real-time transactions happen. But usually, if you look at some of the marketplace businesses that are growing, it's these periphery teams that are built out first. It doesn't make sense to automate matching, it doesn't make sense to automate pricing if the supply doesn't exist and the demand doesn't exist and it's not a safe product. What is the responsibility of a marketplace tech team? Let's walk through kind of the canonical example of someone requesting an Uber ride. So this is a writer, this is a driver. So it starts with a shopping stage. I've opened the app, I have an intention to ride. Or if you take Airbnb, I've opened the website, I have an intention to book. So the first thing that a rider or a consumer sees is a recommendation. These are the Airbnbs available in the location you're looking at. We have 5 or 6 Uber vehicles around you right now. Then there's the decision stage. The decision stage is where kind of the marriage of supply and demand happens, matching riders with drivers, matching hosts with people who need to be hosted. Then there's the kind of on-trip, on-stay stage, and then kind of long-term looping back to both the supply and demand, making sure they stick around on your platform and come back for another transaction. There are equivalent states on the driver side. So what's blocked out under there is the online stage. A driver goes online, I'm ready, I have a couple of hours to spare, I want to drive for Uber, give me a request. Then there's a decision stage. Oh, we found you a trip. This trip is 15 minutes. It's going to make you $10. It's going from point A to point B. Will I accept it or reject it? The on-trip stage, now I'm actually offering a service. And then long-term, am I going to come back and drive for Uber tomorrow when I have some spare time, or is it not worth my while? And these kind of rider and driver relationships are mirror images of one another. The marketplace tech team in any large marketplace business is responsible for all the tech that goes into the experience from the time you start shopping, or in the case of the driver, go online, all the way till a transaction is completed and we need to loop back. In particular, the main tech components are around matching and recommending. So here, when we start recommending a relationship, and here when we close a relationship. The second key tech component is pricing. So supply and demand pricing. How much am I willing to give the driver for the service? How much do I need to make this worth my while? And then loyalty and customer buyback pricing. I got a Lyft promo, so I'm going to take a Lyft instead of an Uber next time. Or as a driver, I have some kind of promo. If I finished X number of trips, I'm going to get an Y number of dollars in bonus. So any kind of pricing systems that are not on trip, but more long term, also belong within the marketplace organization. Then a critical part is any rebalancing mechanism. This is not always tech-based. In some cases, it's just manual. But in companies kind of the size of Uber and Lyft and Airbnb, rebalancing mechanisms are very often automated because they need to respond in real time. Like a concert got out, I need to start surging to create supply. Or something's wrong, I'm not getting as many rider requests right now. So communicating that back to the driver to make sure that not as many drivers are sitting idle. So rebalancing mechanisms, pricing, matching, and the fourth one is quality control. Reviews, ratings, support, and then tying that back into our matching and pricing decision is the fourth kind of main tech component of marketplace businesses. So matchmaking, it is unopinionated and network optimized. What is best for everyone in my network, and what is best in a purely unbiased way? So matchmaking can come in three forms. So any kind of recommendation-based matching. So Airbnb is recommendation-based matching. Here are my needs, what are my options, let me pick. Yelp is another example of a company that does recommendation-based matching. Second is real-time matching. Your Lyfts, Ubers, Postmates, DoorDashes of the world are making real-time decisions, real-time matching decisions on your behalf, and making optimized decisions that way. And third, arranged marriage-based matching. So this is for people who are big Fiddler on the Roof fans. The Matchmaker song makes me happy. So why does matchmaking have to be unopinionated and network optimized? Let's imagine in a world we were making purely greedy, first-in, first-out decisions. In this world, this rider shows up on our platform first. and you immediately make a greedy decision saying, okay, you showed up first, I like you, I'm going to give you the closest possible car. Okay, a second later, a rider 2 shows up. Okay, rider 2 shows up a little bit late. You were actually quite close to the first car, but I gave it away. So I have to find you the next possible car. So that's 5 minutes away. Now, if I measure just with the point of view of rider 1, I've made a good decision. I've given this person a 1 minute ETA. Great, they had a great experience. Rider 2, not so much. I got a 5 minute experience. Why? Because I showed up a couple of seconds late. And if I aggregate add up ETAs at a network level, it's 6 minutes. In a network optimized, unbiased view of the world, I make network optimized decision that not only makes optimizations on a transaction level, but makes optimizations at a network level. So I match rider 1 to the closest possible car, and I match rider 2 to the closest possible car, not just with a singular view of the world, but a totally unbiased network optimized view of the world, giving me a network ETA of 4 minutes. So the advantage of matchmaking with a completely unbiased view is while single transactions might vary above and below the mean, when you're optimizing for some kind of network level score, you're making aggregate improved decisions. It's also important for these decisions to be super unbiased. So let's take another example. Instead of in the greedy world, rider 1 showing up first, rider 1 is just a rider I like. This person has given me a ton of business, has 1,000 trips, is a super loyal Uber rider. Rider 2, first trip. I don't know if this person's going to come back. I don't know if this person's going to give me future billings. I'm okay giving this person a worst off experience. In that case, should matching take a different view of rider 1 versus rider 2? Well, if we do that at a network level, we fail in this network optimized metric, where we're optimizing for real-time decisions that at an aggregate level, each transaction is the best possible number to give us the lowest score at a network level. So therefore, a lot of the matching teams you will see in market-based businesses will always push for as unopinionated and as unbiased decisions as their business allows in order to make sure at a network level the best decisions are being made, optimizing for some kind of metric in an aggregate fashion.
But won't this be true for fungible businesses and not for specialty businesses?
Absolutely, that's a really good call out. So in specialty businesses, that's not true because I don't want a Prius, I want a Tesla. In that case, we go back to the recommendation engine model, where in Airbnb, I've picked the Airbnb that I'm choosing to stay in which case those matchmaking promises don't apply. However, the nuance here is Airbnb needs to optimize as much as possible the first 5 results they show me, and that should be optimized for enabling a transaction as opposed to some ulterior motives that are not network optimized. So some of those concepts apply there as well. But you're right in the fact that kind of real-time matching related network optimizations is more relevant. All right, let's talk secondly about pricing. So pricing is not simply this is how much I think the service should cost and then standardizing it. It's about finding equilibrium between demand and supply. What does that mean? So if I'm demand, if I'm someone who wants to rent a home or get into a car, I'm asking, hey, is this transaction the best possible return of investment for the $5 I'm about to spend? And what is my next best alternative? I could take a bus, I could walk, I could drive my own car. Is this $5 worth it to me for the value you're about to provide? The supply, the driver, or the Airbnb host is thinking, hey, is this transaction the best possible ROI for my time? Am I being paid substantial enough money for the transaction I'm going to undertake that is worth the time and effort I'm going to spend on it, or the resources I'm going to spend on it? And it is the job of the market-based and pricing stack to think about How do you find that equilibrium? And not just find that equilibrium, but update that based on changing circumstances. So a great example for ride sharing is weather and seasonality. It's raining outside. A lot of people are not going to want to walk. Supplies time is now worth more. Am I going to account for that in my pricing decisions? Or looking at competitors, my closest possible competitor is, let's say DoorDash is saying Postmates is offering a 50% off discount today. So a lot of people are not choosing to use my supply. Am I going to slash prices also? Or am I going to tell a lot of my supply don't show up? You look at user experience. I only know how to use Uber. I don't know how to use Lyft. Have I created loyalty through some user experience related moat that's keeping people on that on my platform because of familiarity or ease of use? And then brand. Do I have loyalty to a certain brand? Do I have some certain feelings towards those brands? And all of those decisions play some kind of part in pricing. And the second thing to think about in terms of pricing is pricing can be over an extended period of time, stabilized and standardized for, let's say, services, or pricing in certain different kinds of businesses, again, back to commodities businesses, might have session level optimizations based on the context of that specific session. And in order to do that equilibrium maintenance between demand and supply, market-based businesses need to understand how much things cost and how much are people willing to pay for that. So for example, how much do things cost? That's a pretty hard problem to solve. Let's take Uber pool as an example. Unmatched pool trips, if two people took pools, each person is spending $10 each. Uber is paying each driver $10 each for going from point A to point B. If those two trips were matched instead, and we only employed one driver to take both those trips, the cost is $16, because the driver is going from point A to B to C to D, as opposed to paying two drivers to go from point A to point B. Being able to predict the cost and using that as input into setting demand level prices is a critical part of doing pricing correctly. The second part of doing pricing correctly is building frameworks for how much something is worth. So for example, if I was an Airbnb PM, or Airbnb pricing PM, I would look at how much does something cost a night and see where my user elasticity is, at which point they convert versus at which point they don't convert. And finding that user elasticity, again, based on seasonality, based on whether or not it's spring break and a lot of people want Airbnbs and this is a spring break destination, and using all of that input into determining users' willingness to pay is also critical input into pricing. So any kind of full pricing marketplace stack is going to marry an understanding of how much something will cost, which is usually a prediction because you're giving prices before the thing happens, and how much it is worth, and putting that together to give you a user-facing price. Now, let's move on to quality control. Quality control can be make or break for market-based businesses. So everyone must have heard about the DD murders, where like one driver ended up murdering one passenger, and then ended up physically abusing another one, or a few bad experiences on Airbnb, some bad experiences on Zomato. So quality control on marketplace service businesses is super duper critical, because one bad review, one bad experience for a service that you're not actually managing end to end can make or break a platform. So quality control teams are super critical to ensure we are learning from our past decisions. But not all these are P99.999 experiences. But for the rest of the quality control experiences, they can be used as mechanisms into future decisions. So for example, can I create a set of super users on my demand and supply and use those quality control mechanisms, such as someone got really great reviews time after time on Airbnb, so I'm going to call them super hosts. If I call them super hosts, as an Airbnb pricing PM, am I able to charge more for those super host accommodations? Am I going to encourage people to book those super hosts more often? Similarly for DoorDash, recommended restaurants, this restaurant delivers food very fast each time. Every time someone takes food from this restaurant, they give it a 5-star review, they keep coming back. Can I use that quality control data, again, in my pricing and matching decisions, making them recommended restaurants, fueling future transactions? Same with premium drivers, verified sellers. Using these quality control mechanisms, and they can take many formats. The most obvious one is reviews, riders and drivers giving each other reviews. But there are other nuanced ones as well, like how responsive is this Airbnb host when they have an incoming message? Or how quickly does a package get from eBay from the seller to the buyer? Or how quickly does a driver get from point A to point B? Or how good the quality of the recommended restaurant's food is? And some of these kind of inherent, not super user-facing metrics could potentially be used as input into quality control and then future pricing and matching decisions. And lastly, rebalancing. So rebalancing mechanisms ensure in real time that the marketplace is keeping and staying healthy. The most canonical example here that all of you should be familiar with is search. Everyone hates it when they open Uber and Lyft and it's 1.5x search. God damn it, Uber, you're just trying to make that extra buck off me. This sucks. Why does this happen? So imagine with me, it's 10 p.m. Beyoncé just finished her last song. You're exiting the concert. And you and 5,000 other people are requesting Ubers and Lyfts at the same time. Imagine a world where search doesn't exist. Rider requests suddenly spike. A bunch of people need to leave the same venue at the same time. What happens then? The drivers that are around the concert venue, their utilization goes way up. That's great. All my drivers were available and online and didn't have a passenger, now have passengers. Driver utilization up. Awesome. It's 10:05. Okay, a few more rider requests came in. I don't have as many drivers anymore. What am I going to do now? I'm going to pull drivers from 10 minutes away, 15 minutes away, from further out neighborhoods, making them drive for unpaid time to the concert, making rider ETAs go up. Okay, I was expecting a 2-minute Uber ETA. Uber, you're giving me a 15-minute ETA. That's not cool. I don't want this 15-minute ETA anymore. Rider requests per sessions go down, which means the number of people who are opening the app and requesting drops precipitously. You're still at 10:15. Also, you gave me a 15-minute ETA. I don't want that. So I'm going to cancel. So this driver who's been spending 5 minutes driving towards me, I wasted that person's time. And I'm not going to pay. I'm going to go look at Lyft. I'm going to walk. I'm going to take the bus. It doesn't work for me. On the other side, drivers are going, why are you making me drive 15 minutes away to a concert venue? I'm going to spend 15 minutes empty. Then I'm going to spend 10 minutes trying to find my passenger. And then the passenger will want a 7-minute trip. I'll make $2. It's not worth my time. This is a bad match. I don't want it. In an unsearched world, a transaction like this, a timeline like this, can really mess things up. Because we didn't have rider requests, too many drivers ended up getting utilized, so we started pulling drivers from further away, which means ETAs went up, which means requests decreased, which means cancellations went up on both riders and drivers. Without surge, marketplace balance gets completely skewed based on external phenomena that we did not predict. And concerts are just one example. This could also manifest in commute times. It could manifest at airports, train stations. Anytime the marketplace kind of goes out of whack. What surge does is it starts inhibiting rider requests on the front, saying, hey, you know what, if you want a car, 1.5x surge, are you willing to pay? And going back to our pricing slides, essentially price is a manifestation of whether demand thinks this is worth their resources. Okay, half my riders are going, no, not worth my resources, I'm gonna pay $15, I'm going to walk. The other half say, yeah, I'm really tired, I'm really drunk, I wanna get into a car right now. So the people willing to pay the 1.5x surge are then pulling in the drivers who are coming from further away, making it worth their time. Making sure ETAs are stabilized, they don't spike up to insane levels, and making sure cancellations are within control. Because any form of cancellation is bad for the network. We've just made someone do work that we didn't end up utilizing. Cancellations has just wasted time. And that's unpaid time for the driver. So surge is the most canonical example I can think of for rebalancing mechanisms. But any kind of marketplace business, whether it's in as real time as the 20 minutes we walked through here, or maybe over a long-term span, some kind of rebalancing mechanism that makes sure demand and supply are always in lockstep with one another. That one of them is not growing to aggregate to proportions that the other side of the marketplace cannot manage. So that was my tech spiel, which was the way to think about marketplace tech businesses is four components: matchmaking, pricing, quality control, and any kind of rebalancing mechanisms. So the one thing to remember about matchmaking always unbiased, making network optimized decisions. Pricing, about finding an equilibrium. How much is someone willing to pay and how much is someone's time worth? Quality control, making sure things we've learned in the past inform decisions we make in the future. And then rebalancing mechanisms like surge make sure the marketplace is healthy. My supply availability and demand are balanced with one another, so experience doesn't completely sink. So at this point, I'm going to switch gears a little bit. We covered the context and the history of market-based businesses. We talked a little bit through the tech that goes into market-based businesses. And I want to spend a little bit of time now talking about product managing market-based businesses. Who are the kinds of product managers that are successful in the market-based business? What kinds of skills would you need to develop if this is something you want to do yourself? And what are some of the nuances of the skills required? So, a lot of people ask me, what would you say that I do here? Well, I say, I'm a people person. No, I'm not. I don't know people. So a typical marketplace product manager is super data-driven, very quantitative, has an eye for experimentation, has an eye for always being very critical and asking why. Someone who's willing to make hard trade-offs, for example, being able to say that if I increase my prices for Uber Pool by 1%, I'm going to lose 0.5% of trips. Is this worth it to the business, and how do I manage that in a common currency? Third, owns the P&L for her business areas, not just being responsible for the features themselves, but also for the actual balance sheet of what the business is responsible for, is under the purview of a marketplace product manager. And lastly, dealing with complex market-specific decision-making and nuances. So for example, the awareness of something's going to work in Riyadh, but it's not going to work in Lahore, but it really works well in San Francisco, and being aware of some of those marketplace-specific phenomena and using that in your decision-making. And that's a little bit different from software product management skills. So, for example, a software PM, pulling on my experience from Marketplace, mainly is interacting with engineers, designers, other PMs, coordinating, project managing, and so forth. Marketplace PMs, your best friends are ops, finance, legal, policy, data science. Like, these are the people you're interacting with on a day-to-day basis, learning about specific nuances and talking experimentation. Software PMs responsible for product metrics. How many people clicked on this? How many people bought this thing? How many people watched this video? How many people liked on it or commented on it? marketplace PMs, we're looking at business metrics. How did I grow my gross bookings? What are my net inflows? How much did I give out in promotions and subscriptions? How much did my trips grow? These are things that directly impact the balance sheet of the business overall. Software PMs are building global with localized features. I'm building the Windows 7 start button that's going to work the same way whether someone in Saudi Arabia opens it versus Australia opens it, with some localization that's relevant. Software, for the most part, is global and universally translatable. Marketplace PMs are making super hyper-local decisions with global features. So regulations for ride-sharing in India might look very different from regulations for ride-sharing in Europe. How do I account for that in my decision-making? How do I account for that in my marketplace technology, in my pricing decisions? And how do I make hyper-local things, but with as generalizable tech as possible, so my engineers are not building country-specific tech? And software PMs own features. Marketplace PMs are owning business verticals. So what does that actually look like on a day-to-day basis? So a day in the life of a marketplace PM. And what I want to illustrate here is a lot of it is regional specific nuance. So you're spending a bunch of time saying, hey, should I launch this feature in New York? And then my EMEA team is saying, I want this feature, or I want you to launch this product, or there has been a new government regulation. Then you can't do this anymore because it's illegal. Or going back and looking at city-specific experiments, like I made this change in Denver and I wanted to see how the people in Denver are performing vis-a-vis the people in Austin, and running those experiments to get those insights. A lot of what you're doing on a day-to-day basis is kind of focusing your attention on different geos one at a time and seeing how things are changing. Then you're doing your standard product management, like design requirements, engineering requirements, talking to your engineers, making sure things are being built on time. Then you're doing a lot of, we talked about tech product management, you're doing a lot of strategy and vision. How does my business look aggregate overall 6 months from now, a year from now? Which are the markets I want to put my resources in? Which of the markets are already capping out? Which markets have a ton of competitors right now, which means I have to pump a lot of budget into it? And then you're doing a lot of market level launches and experimentation. If I turn something on in Denver, I'm going to experiment with it, so then maybe I can learn something that's transferable to Austin and Portland later, and being able to do marketplace specific things like that. Yes.
Can you explain your responsibility exactly? Because there is only one Uber app, so what is your, how do you partition the responsibilities between the various PMs?
Yeah, of course. Great question. Yes, there is just one Uber app with like 10 distinct screens. So why do we need a product management team of over 100 people? Specifically, what I do in Uber on the marketplace team is I'm responsible for shared rides pricing and matching decisions. So for example, when you call an Uber pool, do you get matched with someone? How far out of your way you're taken? What price are you paying for that? And how much is the driver being paid out? Mm-hmm. All belongs within this pricing and matching stack that we talked about earlier. Similarly, there are other business verticals across the marketplace organization at Uber that handle those vertical questions as well. Like there's a team that's thinking about subscriptions. There's a team that's thinking about driver incentives. There's another team that's thinking about experimentation and metrics. And that's just within the core marketplace tech team. Then there are a lot of PMs thinking about the other parts of the business, like if I am someone who wants to drive for Uber, what is the experience I'm having? How do I get on the platform? How do I take my first trip? On the rider side, is it intuitive to use this app? I've never used Uber before, how do I take my first trip? So we've mainly focused a lot of this talk on specifically talking about marketplace PMs, and therefore a lot of what I'm most familiar with is pricing and matching problems, but there's a lot of PM brain power across the organization that thinks about experience questions as well.
Would you say most of what you do falls in the marketplace side, or does it also fall on the product side as well? How does it balance?
So it depends on what we define as product versus marketplace. We have very strong ops finance teams that are doing a lot of the day-to-day running and decision-making at a granular level. Like, for example, deciding if any given city is going to have a big event and therefore needs a promo. Marketplace PMs are making decisions about where do I want this region to go. So for example, I want to grow my Uber business in, let's say, the UAE by 5%. What are the features I'm going to roll out in order to enable that? So one part of your brain, you're spending thinking about that. The other stuff you're thinking about is strategy. Like, how do I make my Uber pool tech as first grade as possible so that matches happen seamlessly each time and they're very intuitive decisions? Some of those are globalized decisions. So I would call both of that product management. Some of it is regional, some of it is more globalized and feature level, but all of that still falls under the purview of marketplace product manager. So with that, I'm going to stop talking. I hope this was useful.
Thank you for listening to the Product Podcast. If you like this episode, don't forget to leave a review on iTunes. For more product insights, head over to productschool.com.